You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione.
This episode is brought to you by Wisefish, a business solution built for the seafood industry. Whether you're in farming, fishing, processing, or handling seafood sales, Wisefish helps you manage your entire value chain in one connected system. Learn more at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent.
Well, August 1st finally arrived, and U.S. President Donald Trump updated all his country-specific tariffs. But, surprise, Trump has thrown another curveball. This week, he announced in an executive order that the U.S. will increase the tariff on Indian imports by a further 25% on top of the previously announced 25%.
India's full additional tariff rate to the U.S., including pre-existing countervailing and anti-dumping duties, will now rise to 58.26%. The penalty issued by Trump ties into the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war. Trump has accused the government of India of directly or indirectly importing Russian oil.
India is the single largest supplier of frozen shrimp to the U.S., accounting for roughly 40% of the country's total shrimp imports last year. The country generated roughly $2.35 billion in export revenue just through the sales of shrimp to the U.S. last year. And before this new tariff rate, just to give you an idea of India compared to other Asian exporters, Vietnam has a combined tariff rate of 48.6%, Indonesia 22.9%, and Thailand at 19%. But looking at India's main rival for the U.S. market, Ecuador has a combined tariff rate to the U.S. of just 18.78%.
Right now, the U.S. is buried in imported shrimp, with UCN America's editor Jason Huffman noting this week is largely in thanks to the tariff deadlines set by Trump. The U.S. imported over 413,000 metric tons of shrimp worth $3.4 billion in the first 6 months of 2025. That's 18% more volume and 28% more value than the 351,000 metric tons worth $2.7 billion that was imported in the first 6 months of 2024. Jason reports that the U.S. has now seen year-on-year shrimp volume increase for 8 consecutive months dating back to November 2024. But June specifically had a pretty crazy showing, and it's not hard to see why. There was the earlier deadline of July 9th, on which Trump threatened a tariff jump from the generalized 10% rate he set in April to much higher nation-specific rates. He later postponed the new tariff deadline until August 1st, and then this Thursday, August 7th, and also adjusted the rates for several countries that agreed to deals, which, as we just spoke about, he continues to adjust.
Jason reports that the current import levels are on pace to nearly match the record set in 2021 when shrimp imports spiked following the pandemic. However, Undercurrent News senior price analyst Gary Morrison doesn't believe that's likely to happen.
What's Gary's hot take, Lauren?
So he predicts a second half lull in U.S. shrimp imports. His reasoning is that so much of it is sitting in U.S. cold storage from the earlier rush. With its global team of reporters, Undercurrent News is the source for go-to daily tariff updates and how it impacts the seafood industry. Check out the show notes for links to more insight into the impact of the tariffs on the shrimp market and more in Undercurrent News' ongoing trade war blog.
Tariffs continue to dominate the daily conversation and likely will continue to for a while. But for me, the big story this week involved Alaska pollock. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that it's looking to make a massive $100 million investment in Alaska pollock, using funds made available to it by previously collected tariffs. So U.S. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins announced late last week that the USDA intends to purchase up to $230 million in fresh seafood, fruits, and vegetables from American farmers and producers to distribute to food banks and nutrition assistance programs across the country through Section 32. And Lauren, I got to tell you, when I usually see these notices and seafood is mentioned, it's usually like a tiny slice of the pie.
Yeah, this is huge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I scrolled all the way to the bottom of this announcement and I swear my eyes bulge out of my head. Of that $230 million, the USDA carved out $100 million worth of Alaska pollock products. And
pollock.
But on top of it, catfish, farm-raised catfish also got carved out $20 million. So $120 million out of the $230 million is for seafood, which is wild.
That's great.
Yeah, that's really great. Exciting, especially when we consider what it's Section 32. So it's going to food banks and nutrition assistance programs. So it's really a great win, not just for Pollock, for
in
anybody.
General, yeah.
Yeah. So, but the 100 million specifically is just really crazy, because when you look at fiscal year 2019, which currently holds the record as the biggest year by value ever for USDA purchase of Alaska Pollock, 2019 was at $76.3 million.
Wow.
Yeah, and now they want to buy 100 million, but they've already bought 58.3 million. So if, you know, or once they fully award this $100 million, the USDA for fiscal year 2025 would in total have bought $158.3 million, which blows
that's
fiscal year 2019
incredible.
Out of water. Yeah,
that's incredible.
It truly, truly is. And like I said, the other really interesting about Section 32 was that USDA Section 32 allows access 30% of the gross receipts from customs duties collected in previous years. So I never really thought about the connection to tariffs. And of course, this isn't the money for these 100 million and 20 million for catfish isn't coming from tariffs that are, you know, collected from Trump recently, their previous tariffs, but it'll be really interesting to see if these recent tariffs will result in even more seafood purchases under Sections 32 in the future.
The one thing that you can look forward to from these tariffs. Now on to UCN's top story of this week, back-to-back salmon die-offs at Canadian seafood conglomerate Cook Aquaculture's Newfoundland and Labrador Sea Farms. That's right. The company reported a combined loss of more than 56,600 fish in a span of just 2 days.
Undercurrents, Lisa Meyer reported earlier this week on the story, the company's local operating arm, which is Cold Ocean Salmon, filed public notices with the province's Department of Fisheries, Forestry, and Agriculture, confirming the mortality events at its Grip Cove and Olive Cove sites. The most recent report was made on Thursday, July 31st, and they report that 17,662 smolts died during transfer operations. Cold Ocean Salmon attributed the losses to mechanical issues during transfer from a well boat, causing increased acclimation strain. And just 2 days earlier, on Tuesday, July 29th, the company reported a larger mortality event at its Olive Cove site, where 38,942 fish died. That site had been actively harvesting when the die-off began earlier in July. So Lisa's story could be found in the show notes. You can read more on that there. More on Lisa's story in the show notes.
Despite these mortality issues, there is still plenty of salmon going around in the global salmon market. And let me dive into it. So the first dramatic movement that we saw this week was out of Norway. U.S. wholesale prices for fresh Norwegian fillets dropped sharply this week, down about 30 to 35 cents a pound across key sizes. And that puts Norwegian pricing on par with Chilean products for the first time in months. And it wasn't just fillets, whole fish slipped around 10 cents a pound, and frozen portions also dropped 15 cents a pound, landing fresh market values at some of the lowest levels we've seen this year. The driver there, heavy harvest pressure. Norway's July exports hit a record 136,000 metric tons, and that was up 28% from last year. The U.S. still took a good chunk of that volume, but price growth was sluggish. Now, turning to Chile, a softer story, but still important. Filet prices were mostly flat to down a little bit, easing about 5 cents on core sizes like 3 to 4s and 4 to 5s. Seasonal demand remains quiet, and Chilean offers are facing stiff competition from both Norwegian product and the U.S. domestic wild salmon harvest. One segment that held firm are frozen portions, particularly 6 to 8 ounce sizes. Spot inventories are very tight, and there's no new production expected until at least September there. And then there's Canada, where we've seen a recent rebound after wholesale prices dropped sharply last week. That was due to processors rushing harvest ahead of warm water threats and sea lice issues, and that flooded the market, driving prices down. This past week, there was a holiday in Canada, so that shortened the production week, and prices have rebounded a bit there. If you want to check out, Barb Dean Simmons also wrote a story on what's happening in Canada, a bit of a deeper dive, and she did an excellent job. So we can link that in the show notes as well. But depending on which origin, things are definitely moving in the global salmon markets.
A quick word about Wisefish. proud sponsor of Catch the Current. Wise Fish is a business solution purpose built for the seafood industry, backed by over 30 years of experience. Whether you're in farming, fishing, processing, seafood sales, or doing all of the above, Wise Fish helps you work more efficiently across the entire value chain, from daily workflows to cost control, traceability, and sustainability. As seafood businesses scale, operations become more complex. Wise Fish replaces spreadsheets and removes siloed systems, enabling scalable growth, compliance, and making faster, data-informed decisions. Learn more at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent. Now joining us on the pod to talk about what's going on in the world of wild salmon is our pal, UCN reporter, Jacob Resnick. Jacob, you published a story this week that the salmon harvest in Alaska is at its halfway point of its projected 2025 landings. Can you break it down for us?
Yeah, I mean, we're at like halfway point overall with over 106 million fish caught. That's across five species. But, you know, they come in at different times. But the lion's share and what we really what we're talking about, the big ones, is the wild sockeye. And Bristol Bay really went gangbusters this season. They're wrapped up and done. And they were up quite a bit. McKinley Research puts out a really helpful harvest update every week for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. What they've shown is we've broken 106 million fish across five species. The big driver of this, of course, has been the Bristol Bay wild sockeye. That's been a real success story this year. And year over year, they're up 29%. Had a pretty lackluster year. So this is something they really needed. So overall, I think Bristol Bay, they've broken over 40 million fish. And this time last year, they were at like not even 32 million. So it's a really good thing. There's been a lot of concern about, you know, too much sockeye, too quick on the market. What will that do with prices? The shorter answer is we don't know yet. When I talk to people who track this sort of thing, they tell me that since there was such a low harvest last year, there really isn't any inventory left over from 2024. So there's a lot of demand right now. And wild sockeye is a pretty niche item when it comes to, you know, salmon, since like it really can't compete in volume with like farmed Atlantic salmon, things like that. So there's a lot of optimism that the market will be able to absorb the product. The deals are being made right now with the middlemen, the distributors, between the producers and the distributors, when it ultimately gets to the end consumers, restaurants, supermarkets, things like that. The dust has not settled yet, but we're going to be watching that really closely to see what happens with the actual wholesale salmon market. That's just too soon to tell.
All right. Well, anytime anybody has any optimistic news on a market, we are all for it. So thanks for that update, Jacob. I also wanted to ask you about a fun little field trip that you got to go on last week involving the Coast Guard.
Yeah, I don't live that far away from one of their largest West Coast bases. It's down in Alameda, California. And the national security cutter Monroe had just gotten back into port. They were up in the Bering Sea for about 4 months. And, you know, the U.S. Coast Guard, they're kind of the traffic cops of the EEZ, you know, the Federal Waters and Fisheries, and they do regular boardings of U.S. fishing vessels. And they also patrol up there to just watch what other countries are doing, make sure there aren't any foreign fishing vessels coming into the EEZ, because it's a 200 nautical mile exclusive fishing zone. I got to sit down with the commander to see what they saw up there. They say the good news is the U.S. fishing fleet is largely like 95% in compliance with all the health and safety kind of things. They do regular boardings for these, you know, large harvester processors, longliners, everything up there. And it was just kind of interesting to see their perspective of kind of being the highway patrol, if you will, of the high seas. They didn't have any trouble up there. You know, they see the Russians, they see the Chinese, things like that. You know, we get a lot in the news about Russian and Chinese vessels up in the Arctic, because there is a lot of posturing, you know, geopolitical posturing. And it's usually not about fishing. It's usually about oil and gas exploration, stuff like that. What the Coast Guard's been telling me is they didn't see anything provocative. I mean, it is still international waters, so foreign vessels can go through, they can transit. They can't fish, though. They have to make sure. They didn't see any foreign fishing vessels in U.S. waters, and there hasn't been anything that we need to worry about so much. But they said that it's, you know, it's important that they have that presence, because they meet presence with presence is kind of their tagline. And if they weren't there, well, then it wouldn't be so exclusive, because there would be no one to patrol those waters. We're going to have a feature story about the perspective of the U.S. Coast Guard up in Bering Sea coming up on Undercurrent shortly.
Thanks, Jacob. Before you go, I'm going to ask you to join Lauren and I in this final conversation But first, I have a question for you both. How many oysters have you ever eaten in one sitting?
Oh gosh, in one sitting, maybe like a dozen and a half. What about you, Jacob? I feel like it's got to be more.
I would say similar. I don't think I've ever been able to afford more than two dozen in a sitting. We usually shuck them ourselves. I was just looking, you know, when Facebook, you know, says, here's a picture of your kids when they wanted to hang out with you. 5 years ago, when my kids, they were like 2 and 3, slurping down raw oysters in 2020.
You know, my youngest does seem to like boogers, so I feel like I might be able to get her to enjoy some raw oysters.
My son still, he loves raw oysters, but I think the most I could probably do would be two dozen.
I don't think I've ever honestly eaten more than a dozen oysters. I'm not going to go out and just get oysters. I want to get something else for dinner. So I'm not probably getting more than that. I would split, you know, like a dozen,
yeah,
two dozen oysters.
You order some for the table, yeah, and then you go through those a little bit quick, and then you're like, oh, does anybody want any more? And then you keep adding.
All right,
to
fine.
It,
yeah, yeah, and- yeah. One more round. Okay. One restaurant in Louisiana is challenging people to eat 180 raw oysters.
No.
With an hour on the clock.
That's too much.
So the restaurant is called Acme Oyster House. It's in New Orleans. Supposedly, breaks are permitted, but bathroom trips are closely supervised.
Ew.
Are they small? Are they like gnocchis?
Yeah, what kind of oysters are we talking about here?
You know, I didn't look into it. I'm just going to assume it's like the biggest, meatiest thing you could find. Okay, let's compromise on something in the middle. Either way, even if it was small ones, do you think you could handle 180?
No.
How many people do they have shucking those things?
This is counteractive to increasing seafood consumption. Because if you do that, I feel like you'd never want to see another oyster in your entire life.
I don't think I could do it, but I would be game to try.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You could order from this website. It ships through Gold Belly. So we could reach out, see if you could participate in the challenge virtually.
Do you win?
The glory, Lauren, the honor, the bragging rights.
More oysters.
Of being part of the honorary 15 dozen club. Yeah. And there's already 159 people currently in it.
You should have queued up somebody who is in this 15 dozen club to be a guest on the podcast this week. Maybe next week. Let's see if we can do it.
Do they comp you if you eat them? Do they comp you?
I don't think so. Again, these are all great questions. I just saw
go do more research.
next
bring
week.
A guest.
But there is so I would say there's 159 people that did this, that they ate 15 dozen, but there's actually some overachievers. And you guys want to guess how many Brad from Uniontown, Pennsylvania ate to claim the title of the leader
of
the house?
People have gone above and beyond the
way. Yes, there's people that have ate more than that. More than 180. Guess, take a guess.
207.
230.
Okay. 516 oysters. That's 43 dozen.
Get Brad on the line right now. I have questions.
It's like that
Brad,
John Candy movie. There's that John Candy movie, The Great Outdoors, where he eats the 96-ounce sirloin.
Just imagine, imagine Brad out with his wife and kids visiting Louisiana, and he sees this competition, and his wife's like, don't do it, Brad. The kids want to go do this thing tomorrow. And he's like, let me just
and
see
he gets
get
up
there.
And does the Frank the Tank hand motions, and is like, yeah.
And then this table starts showing one more round, yeah. One more round. And then he's at 516 oysters passed out in the parking lot. His wife, Janine, is so upset. The holiday's ruined.
I think Undercurrent should probably sponsor us to try it.
If anybody wants to see Jacob, Lauren, and I eat 180 oysters in one sitting.
I'm the wing woman. I will get your waters. I will get the napkins, but I will just be watching that.
Well, that does it for us. Thanks for tuning in to Catch the Current. The seafood business is complex, but Wisefish makes it clearer and more connected, helping companies keep everything flowing smoothly. Whether it's aquaculture, fisheries, processing, or seafood sales, Wisefish powers smarter decisions, better traceability, and clearer insights every day. Find out how at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent.